The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, here we go, man. It's Talk is Jericho, the pot of thunder and rock and roll. It's the remedy for boredom, and guess what? It's my favorite day of the week. It's Friday.
It's Friday, Friday. Gotta get down on Friday.
And today, Ring of Honor kicking it on Talk is Jericho today with two of their longest tenured veterans on the roster. Chris Daniels and Frankie Kazarian are here. You'll hear all about how they ended up as a tag team, what inspired the throwback Thursday gimmicks, what they did to get so much heat after AJ Styles left Ring of Honor. Chris Daniels also talking about his very short run in WCW and why it didn't work out as planned. And then, of course, Frankie's got some great stories about training with Killer Kowalski, why he was fired from the WWE before ever really stepping a foot in the ring. If you've read my book, Undisputed, you might know the reason why. You hear all these great stories. Of course, talking about Curry Man as well. If you haven't heard about Curry Man, you wait and see. All stuff coming up for Addiction, as they are called, Daniels and Kazarian. And you're going to find out all about the Ring of Honor New Japan joint events coming up this week, May 8th, I believe that is a Sunday. That's going to be in Chicago Ridge, Illinois, Global Wars pay-per-view. Then May 9th, War of the Worlds Tour in Dearborn, Michigan. And then we got War of the Worlds Tour in Toronto, Ontario on May 11th. And then May 14th, New York City, War of the Worlds. Once again, I believe that's a TV taping. So much stuff coming up. Ring of Honor is hot right now, and Frankie and Christopher are leading the way. But first, I got to say thanks to all of you for supporting the great sponsors of this podcast. That's why I'm able to do two shows a week for free. That's right. And that's doing it for you guys because we love you. And also because of my great sponsors, including DDP, Diamond Dallas Page, DDP Yoga, and the DDP Yoga Now app, a great move for your own health and fitness needs. DDP Yoga is a great investmente to make on yourself. You know how much I love DDP Yoga, what it's done for me. It's put me back in the ring, put me back on stage, put me in great shape. I can't say enough about it. And if you're sitting on the fence, get off your ass and jam, man. Get out there and do it. If you haven't given Diamond Dallas Page's amazing fitness program a try, here's your chance, all right? Order it now, ddpyoga.com/Jericho. And if you do this, you'll receive 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app, okay? This app is technologically as advanced as it comes. All of the workouts on the app, everything at your fingertips on your device, you need to give it a try. I use this app quite often. That's how I do my DDP Yoga now these days. No more DVDs. And that's why I'm in the best shape of my life. That's why I'm the best in the world at everything I do. Do you understand what I'm saying to you right now? It gets heat every time. I love it. But I'm in great shape, having some of the best matches of my career still at this day and age at 45. Chris Jericho's lost a step, the punters may say. Well, I may have lost a step, but I probably had more steps than anybody else. Hey, oh, yeah, boy. Yeah, that's what DDP Yoga has done for me. Also, so convenient because I've been on the road so much. I don't have to lug around them DVDs. I just watch the exercises on the phone. I just do the exercises on my device whenever I want. You guys know, anywhere you want, hotel room, backstage, dressing room, on the street, whatever. It's so easy when everybody wants to please me, baby. How about Axl Rose debuting with AC/DC tomorrow night in Lisbon, Portugal, as Angus called it. But Angus should be doing some DDP Yoga. He could use it. I know I'm doing it. I know you'll love it. Angus would love it. You got to try it. DDP Yoga Now app. You will give it a try and you will love it. It's got all the workouts on it. Also live workouts from the DDP Yoga Performance Center. Tons of nutrition tips, inspiration stories, and videos. And you can even access cooking shows so you can see how to prepare healthier meals for yourself and your family. All right. DDP Yoga Now app, available at iTunes and the Google Play Store. And when you do download it, you'll see all the amazing reviews it's getting. Leave a review of your own. Take advantage of the special offer DDP has given you guys. Order it now, ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app. All right, get started today. Get in the best shape of your life. Thank you, DDP. Thank you, Chris Jericho. Thank you, ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Go check it out. You got nothing to lose and everything to gain.
Talk is Jericho.
Nothing but the best for my guests. Some fine H2O. Here with vets, grizzled vets, Chris Daniels and Frankie Kazarian. And it's funny because we've known each other for a long time, but we've never really worked in the same company for any length of time, if at all.
The closest would be doing dark matches and job matches back in the day, back when, I remember the first time I met you was early 2000. And I was my first time ever doing a dark match.
Really?
And back then it was different. Like, I went and plopped my bag in the locker room right next to you and Bob Holly. And I opened up my bag and I had a copy of Metallica S&M, which had just come out.
Okay, right.
And you like went, hey man, can I take a look at that? And I'm like, sure. And you're like, what's your favorite track on that? And like, it immediately put me at ease.
Yeah.
And I also had a Quiet Riot CD and Bob's like, can I look at that? And I'm like, sure. And I'm like, cool. So like it immediately.
I'm going to take
like,
this.
He could have too. So, but yeah, I remember that was the first time I like met you in a.
Okay.
But I was a jabron indie guy, like
just coming in for a tryout.
Sure, sure. But you were kind enough to like engage in conversation. I was like, cool.
And it
was
the connection of music,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
It's always that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And how about us, Chris? I mean, I met you. I don't even remember when.
It had to have been in 2000, but you had already left WCW when I signed my first contract with them and started traveling with them. You were already
okay.
In
gone.
WWF. Yeah. So. I can't remember the first time
we a guy that's always been around. Like yeah. whenever like,
I know, those. I know that all the times that I had done dark matches around like after 2000, when I left WCW and started doing dark matches again, you were around and again, you were always cordial and you never treated us like, hey, get out of here, kid. You know what I mean?
I got you guys kicked out of the dressing room. I said, like, these guys are in here talking to me. Get them out of here.
On that same show, it might've been that show or the next day. This is when I had Curtis Hughes with you for a minute.
Wow.
And I think you had wrestled Ken Shamrock.
Yeah.
And something happened, and they came in the back, and they got, like, almost into blows.
Curtis Hughes and Shamrock?
Yes, because I guess Curtis caught him with something.
Wow.
And he came in the back, and they're screaming, and I'm standing, like, from where you – and I'm just, like mortified, like, and, like, they had to be, like, pulled apart. And, like,
that's crazy.
I think it was more Ken on him than he was kind of –
Ken was a little bit – wacky,
right.
Around that time, we were. I had a match with him, and I chopped him a couple times. And then he like instantly attacked me and put me like in a pretzel and like pie faced me and all this stuff. And afterwards, I was like, what happened? He goes, well, you chopped me. You can't chop me. He goes, that's pussy shit. What am I supposed to do? Sell that? I'm like, well, just don't beat me up. Don't do that anymore. You know. But it's interesting to me because you guys and there's a few guys out there. I said this when the Young Bucks did the show. Couple others, but you guys are like at the top of the ladder when it comes to the independent scene to where you guys are like, you don't really have to go anywhere else at this point. You've been everywhere and it seems like you guys are always working and still doing really well, which is kind of a rare thing in this day and age when it's all based around WWE and Ring of Honor and TNA sort of thing. And Ring of Honor is your place, but
yeah. We're having fun. I think that's the, you know, we're still having fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially since we've been a team, it's probably been the funnest run of my career.
Wow.
You know, just because, you know, when you get to be on the road with your best friend and just have the type of matches we've had, it's been awesome. And yeah, like, you know, we still have that freedom to do what we want and we're still performing at the top of our game. You know, that's not an issue at all. And it's,
which is amazing too, because a lot of people really get fixated on the age thing. I mean, I get it all the time, but it really doesn't, it's, if you're taking care of yourself and wrestling smart, you still can work at the top of your game, whether you're 25, 35, 45, whatever it may be.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it, too, is like if you're not working for WWE, the odds are good that you're not working that schedule, that grind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you talk about someone like Daniel Bryan, who just retired at 34, and like I started before him, and I'm still wrestling, but I never had the schedule that he had. Like, obviously, the last 6-7 years of his career were – at full tilt, you know what I mean? 4 or 5 days a week,
which
of
is true,
the grind.
Yeah.
And that'll do it. You know, the repetition of it will tear you up. Mm-hmm. Like at most, like when I was doing Michinoku Pro or stuff, I would do, you know, 3 days a week, 4 days a week, sometimes five, but it was like, you know, 1 month out of the year. And then the rest of the time I'd be doing, you know, 2 or 3 shows a week, maybe.
When TNA was running, like the toughest schedule they were running was when we would do live TVs on Thursdays, house show Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and did that every week. And that was a span of what, maybe 6 8 months, a year maybe?
At most a year.
Yeah, and we did that, and, you know, that was you know.
And that wasn't every weekend either.
Wow.
You know, so. It was every week they would do the live Thursday, but not every week would have live events. It would be like every other week, every 3 weeks.
That must
perhaps.
Have been a great schedule because, like, you know, people, TNA gets a lot of flack, but at the time, TNA was actually a pretty good growing company that was drawing some good crowds with this really basically easy schedule. It must have been a dream for you guys.
And think of the roster they had at the time.
Yeah.
Too, you know,
a lot of the guys that we worked with, like, came up with us through TNA. And so you were basically working with your friends on that schedule, on a lighter schedule. You know, even when it was every week, it was fun. And we were, it was almost like that little engine that could, the idea, like, we were all together and we were fighting to get that recognition and try to make TNA, you know, we sort of knew it wasn't going to become the exact same as WWE, but we had the idea, like, oh, well, the more we can grow this, you know, we're at the ground floor. We're building this.
It was our company. It was our home. Yeah. It was like, this is going to be maybe our legacy. So, you know, this is if.
So what do you think the peak of TNA was?
Let's see.
Probably the beginning of the Spike era.
Yeah.
And then not to be like, hey, it was us.
It ended right when we left.
Right around when we left, man. Well, I mean, honestly, I think when AJ left was the beginning of the end for them. Mm-hmm. And he left literally 2 months before I did and 4 months before you, less.
Yeah, I would say same. So, like when we first started going to Orlando, which was the end of 2004, the crowd was really responsive. And it was just a great vibe to be in the Impact Zone. The Impact Zone was actually cool. This is before the fans became jaded and
had seen everything.
Yeah, and then
week in, week out.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, so I'd say like 2005 when we got the Spike deal, when TNA got the Spike deal, and it had some momentum. It had a ton of guys that would go on to do...
I agree with
things,
that.
And
because it was homegrown talent,
right? And there were, you know, they obviously had peaks and valleys throughout that period of time. But like, right around 2005, 2006, there was a big peak, I think. And then, you know, that was when October of that year, 2005, we started with Spike. And actually, the first show that we did for Spike was the night that Bubba and Devon came in for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and it wasn't too much longer. Yeah. It wasn't too much longer after that that they announced Kurt, right? Wasn't it?
No, Kurt came in 2006. He came in October 2006.
These are some big signings, though.
Oh, Kurt was huge.
I think Kurt was the guy.
I literally remember being backstage watching because they kept everybody kayfabed. And I'm standing right next to AJ, and we were watching the.
We had just came out of the ring because we did the Ultimate X match with
that's right.
Homicide and Hernandez.
And we're watching the screen. And we're like, what's this? What's it? And then they announced Kurt Angle. And we both were like, giddy. We're like, this is awesome.
This
like,
is
Kurt Angle's coming to
this
our little company.
Right.
And we were so psyched.
Helping to grow it. Yeah.
Oh, God. It was awesome.
What was the turning point, though? Maybe you mentioned AJ leaving stuff, but what was the turning point where you started feeling it go down?
Jeff Jarrett leaving was a sort of a red flag for us. AJ leaving was a red flag.
Management, just, you know, guys coming in, and I always say this, that you cannot, a team's never going to win a Super Bowl if they change head coaches every year or if they change GMs every year. And it seemed like there was just a rotating, you know, roster of talent relations or head of creative. And it always, so nothing was ever, there was no consistency.
Mm-hmm.
So, for me, the end of 2013, I kind of saw the writing on the wall and I wasn't having fun. And, you know,
we were making our own fun, but we felt like we were the only two that were on our side.
Right. How do you mean? How are you doing that?
Well, I mean, that was like the heyday of us as the team for TNA. Like, there was a period of time where I felt like we were the most entertaining thing going on in TNA.
Absolutely.
And I felt like everybody was saying it and everybody saw it except the people that were writing the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like, wait, you know, they kept coming to us and they go, ha, ha, you guys are bulletproof. Yeah, yeah, we can do anything with y'all. And we're like, well, what if you stop burying us? Think of how much better we would be if you didn't bury us.
You got put in that horrible moniker of being called a hell of a hand.
Too entertaining.
Yeah.
You guys, don't worry, you're bulletproof.
Wow.
Oh, you guys can lose a handicap match 3 times in a row because you're bulletproof. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
To a certain extent, but then after a while it has to change.
Yeah.
How did you guys start becoming a team together?
I think we both sort of, like around 2011, they had just split up they had put the Fortune gimmick, they had put the Fortune group together, and that was before I had come back to TNA.
Which was Flair's group with Bobby, James, AJ, myself, and Chris later.
Okay. Yeah. So I came back, they all turned babyface, I came back and joined, and I was the fifth horseman basically, which was weird. And then it was right around that period of time that they split Bobby Roode and James Storm up as a team, and they sort of had AJ sort of go off. Actually, they had me and him sort of get into a little deal. And
I was the guy breaking up fights between Chris and AJ. Literally, right. I was... Chris and AJ had this kind of mini feud going, and I was literally Johnny Voice of Reason.
Oh.
That was it in the occasional match, but it was like they had nothing. Like, I was just a guy.
So you're basically like the agent who comes up to break up the fight.
Pretty much, yeah. I was just like, no, don't fight, guys. Be friends.
Let's
like,
be pals.
Yeah, it was
so
just...
I do remember, though, like, at that point in time, they had just split up Beer Money, and the Motor City Machine Guns, who had been there, had gotten injured. Like, Saban had... redone his
ACL.
Heard his other ACL. And like the day that Alex Shelley came back to do that, Saban blew his ACL. So like they didn't have a tag team that was like the marquee tag team.
Right.
And I remember the year that it happened, the Bound for Glory, which was basically our WrestleMania, they had the tag team titles on the pre-show with Mexican America, which was Hernandez and another guy. And then against Shannon Moore and Jesse Neal called Ink Ink. And I remember going, yeah, because
Ink,
they because
it,
they were all
because
tied
they
up,
had
right?
tattoos, you see.
I get it.
It's, yeah,
so,
I get
bump,
it.
Bump, bump, bump. So anyway, I was just like, okay, well, they need a tag team. They're not doing anything with me. They're not doing anything with Frankie. And I don't remember if I came to you or you came to me or we both came
we
together
both,
and we're
we
like, hey,
kinda,
let's go
yeah.
be a team.
We both
and then shook hands and a lightning bolt.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
yeah. And there it began. So, so yeah, so we pitched. I had just turned heel against AJ, and we went to the office and we're like, hey, let us team. Let us do this. And they responded with the idea of the...
Ultimately what became the Claire Lynch angle, which is...
The what now?
The Claire Lynch angle,
oh, okay.
which is, yeah.
It was infamous in its own
infamous,
way.
Yeah, and it turned out... kind of poopy, but you know, it could have been good. But
well, here's the thing, like the thing that was great about that was like they came to us and they're like, okay, Frankie's going to be an unwilling partner to you and you've got some dirt on him. And the original idea was like they were going to be like, oh, Frankie is sleeping with AJ's sister, and so you were going to tell AJ and AJ was going to get mad, and AJ went, wait a minute, if he was with my sister, I'd be thrilled because he's my best pal.
He's a good dude.
So Frankie was the one that came up with the idea that he was trying to protect AJ from this secret that he had with what I thought was AJ and Dixie Carter having an affair, which ended up being AJ maybe having an affair with someone that was supposed to be Dixie's niece.
So I was protecting him.
Convoluted.
I was protecting him and being an unwilling partner. And this team actually wasn't supposed to happen because the culmination was going to be this all, somebody spilled the beans, and then him and I were going to feud.
Right.
And we were like, no, like... No, you don't get it. It was Eric Bischoff at the time who was instrumental and was really, really helpful with us.
How was Eric at that time, Frank?
For us, personally, he was awesome.
Yeah.
Eric Bischoff, Jason Hervey, and Dave Lagana,
mm-hmm.
But especially Eric and Jason, they really, for the first time, at least for me, they gave us so much creative freedom and just collaboration, and it was awesome. And that's when we really
and wanted to hear
us.
Our opinion.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't like,
which
hey, stop talking to us.
Yeah. Yep. You need to have, I mean, no one knows your characters like you guys do.
Exactly.
Right.
It's interesting with Eric because obviously in WCW it was a different time frame, but I heard that he came into TNA with the best of intentions. Like, he really wanted to make some moves and help out.
And he was always very, you know, people have different interactions with different people, but mm-hmm. he was always very honest with me, which is difficult to find.
Yeah.
You know, and like if he thought something wasn't good, he would tell me. If he thought something was great, he would tell me. But just to have that collaboration and be able to bounce ideas and just get the like creative vibe, it was really cool, man. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and Chris, you were also at WCW, so you know how it was there. And I want to talk about that and the gimmick they wanted you to do. And Frankie, you trained with Killer Kowalski, the famous, he's the shits. That was always his quote, he's the shits. I'm sure you've got some great stories about Killer. But before we get into it, man, let me tell you about something I'm doing that I never thought I'd be doing. I'm fixing things around my house. That's a true story. I'm not joking. I've never been that handyman kind of guy. Never been Tim the Tool guy, eh? I'm not good at that stuff, but what I am good at is using Works Switch Driver. It's changed everything for me. I've become a do-it-yourselfer around my house thanks to this handy-dandy tool. The Works Switch Driver, here's what it is. It's a power tool. Lets you drill a hole and drive the screw with one tool, okay? You can leave all those other things behind. You won't believe all the stuff I've used. I built a catapult with Ash for his school assignment. I hung a picture
in my girl's room. Let me tell you, it's like building the damn Taj Mahal for me. So I never would have done it without the work switch driver. I've also done a few things outside. I'm working on installing some shelves. That's what I'm working on. And I can do all these things with the help of the work switch driver. I get things done quicker and easier. Now, here's what it is. The switch driver is cordless, so I don't get tangled up in the cords, don't trip and fall, don't have to worry about someone else and tripping over it and pulling out of the socket while I was drilling. And the switch driver is also powered by a 20-volt max lithium battery. It has a two-speed gear. The dual chucks let you rotate from drill to driver without changing bits, so you can get your work done twice as fast. That's the truth. You can screw it in, you can screw it out. Screw it in, screw it out. And it twists it all about. You do the work switch driver, and you do it all out. That's what it's all about. Well, it's the one power tool you absolutely got to have it. You got to have it. Double your power and save time. What's not to love about that, right? And right now, if you go to workswitchdriver.com, enter the promo code Chris at checkout, you'll receive free shipping and 10% off your order. That's workswitchdriver, W-O-R-X, switchdriver.com. Use the promo code Chris, my first name, C-H-R-I-S, man, and you'll get free shipping and 10% off. Okay, workswitchdriver.com, W-O-R-X, switchdriver.com. Use the promo code Chris and become the handyman you always wanted to be, just like me. Christopher Daniels and Kazarian from Ring of Honor sitting here with me, and we're going to get back to the stories, the great stories coming up. But first, I want to say thanks to TrueCar and the TrueCar app. I'm not thanking them just for being a sponsor of my show. I'm thanking them for also helping me buy a new car, because I used this app to get my new car. I really did use it. Made the whole process so fast. I was in and out of the dealer in 90 minutes, okay? Honestly, I used this app, found the car I wanted to find, ordered it, got all the specifications, got everything taken care of, an hour and a half to buy a brand new car, including the trade-in. When else can you say you've done that in buying a car? You can't. It usually takes hours. And plus, you got to look around your area to find the car you want. Throw all of that old school trash out the window. TrueCar and the TrueCar app can not only help you buy a new car, but buy a used car as well. It's got you covered all the way across the board. There's over 500,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. So whether you're looking for a brand new car or a gently used car, you can get upfront pricing information from TrueCar so you can enjoy a better buying experience. All right. Using TrueCar and the TrueCar app lets you see what other people paid for your car, and you can determine a fair price and feel confident when you buy your car. Okay. TrueCar connects you with a local certified dealer of your choosing who will honor your guaranteed savings, which makes your car buying process quicker and easier, right? Easier. You love it easier. TrueCar users save an average, get this, of $3,279 off MSRP, and over 2 million cars have been sold to TrueCar users by the TrueCar certified dealer network. Don't worry about finding a certified dealer. There's over 11,000 in TrueCar's network. So when you're ready to buy a brand new or used vehicle like I did, about a 2017 Cadillac Escalade, brand spanking new, although I put a scratch on it today, made me mad. Not TrueCar's fault. TrueCar helped me get the job done so quickly. So when you're ready to join this club, visit TrueCar.com or download the TrueCar app to enjoy a better car buying experience. I know I did. All right, do it now. Remember, some features not available in all states.
It's your last chance to get great holiday savings at Guitar Center. Like a Yamaha portable keyboard, only $79. Add a month of lessons for only $99. Plus, the newest and hottest guitars, drums, keys, and more. Exclusive gear you can't get anywhere else. Special financing and gift cards. The perfect present for every musician. So hurry in and find your sound at Guitar Center. Lessons available at select locations only.
All right, let's get back to it with Chris Daniels and Frankie Kazarian right here on Talk is Jericho.
Did you guys do your shows, and then I always heard, and I never got to go, but would you go afterwards out to, was like the Ale House or something? God. You guys would all hang out there?
It started that way, but then once everybody knew that was the hangout, we tried to avoid that place. Like, we would go there, there was nowhere else to eat, but...
Yeah, if we'd hear, like, some, like, WWE guys are in town, we'd be like, oh, we go and, you know, get to see guys you don't see in forever, you know. But, yeah, there was a crew of guys.
Kind of a fun thing, though.
Yeah, yeah. It just, there was a crew of guys that was there every week, and or is that or the Doubletree Bar? But right. Yeah, the Ale House was like Grand Central for debauchery and
because everyone's like, now in WWE, everyone kind of travels around, does their own thing, goes different places. But it's always cool when there's a one place in the middle that everyone knows,
right, to go there.
You know,
and it's rare to even find guys to go out anymore.
I know, you know, right?
Like we're still the guys that are like, well, let's go grab a beverage at the bar. Like that's just there's. few and far between anymore.
It is a rare thing. Yeah. We were in Japan last year after this show at the Sumo Hall, and it was a great time. And we got this, somebody's going to take us out. And I rounded up the strange crew of Doc, the doctor, Xavier Woods, and the Colognes, and me. That was all I could find. Like, you guys don't want to go out and do anything?
I know,
but
man.
That's the way it's become, right?
That's,
well, but Flair was there. Did he? I'm sure he went out.
Oh, yeah. Flair was there. He would normally, he was like a Doubletree bar guy. He would be in the bar. And I had a couple
that,
nights.
The Doubletree bar, they would close it off, so it wasn't like fans coming up to you and be like, hey, can we take a quick picture?
Right.
At the alehouse, you'd be eating, and hey, we don't want to bother you, but
we will anyways.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's take a photo. Let's sign this, and blah, blah, blah.
Or they go like, I hate to bother you, and I'd be like, no, you don't. You know what? I hate spinach, so I don't eat it. You don't hate to bother me.
Yeah, if you did hate it so much.
Yeah, Flair would always be in there. It got to the point where, like, after, you know, having a beer or having some drinks with Ric Flair, I was like, this Ric Flair, this is awesome. But after a while, it'd be like, you know, dragging my bags in. He'd be sitting at the bar and, Kazman! I'd be like, oh, God.
He saw me.
Like, oh, he saw me. Now I have to go
underneath the
radar. Yeah, like, oh, I don't want my liver to fall out.
Were you guys big wrestling fans when you were kids?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
Obsessed.
Who were your favorites?
Growing up in Southern California, I got all WWF. The only way I knew anything about other wrestling was through the Aptermags or the Wrestler, Inside Wrestling. The guys I initially gravitated towards were Tito Santana's, Ricky Steamboat, British Bulldogs, smaller guys that were athletic. So I liked Hulk Hogan, but I always gravitate Bret Hart later on, Shawn Michaels, obviously. The smaller athletic style.
Did you go hang around where they stayed and everything?
No, I would go to the shows at the sports arena. The LA Sports Arena when they ran the house shows. I remember my first one was Hulk Hogan versus Terry Funk. And
wow.
Yeah.
They had a WWE show with Hogan versus Funk?
1986.
Really?
I was a little kid. 1986 at the Sports Arena, Hogan versus Terry Funk.
They were only there for a very short time. It was Jimmy Jack Funk was the third man.
Yep.
I remember. Wow.
Yep. Yeah, that was my first. So I'd go to all the shows out there. And I never bothered to, because I liked watching
it.
How
about you, Chris?
I grew up in Fayetteville, North Carolina, so I was a Crockett Promotions Mid-Atlantic NWA guy. So, like, I remember my first live event, and this was sort of the reason I thought of this was because he just recently passed, but it was Blackjack Mulligan and Jim Brunzel wrestling the Masked Superstars.
Wow.
And so
NWA show?
Yeah. This was, well,
really?
Mid-Atlantic.
Okay,
so
Mid-Atlantic.
Crockett Promotions.
Okay,
so before it was all NWA. But yeah, and so like my first favorite was Magnum TA, and I got to see him live wrestle Flair, wrestle Tully Blanchard, and then
what was the draw for Magnum TA? Because growing up in Canada, I just would see him in the magazines. Never saw a match, but he was super over, right?
Yeah, at the time, Magnum PI was the big television show, and he had a passing resemblance to Tom Selleck. And so that's where the name came from. They called him Magnum TA.
Fine mustache.
He was a burly,
mustache.
Yeah, absolutely. And just, you know, he was a handsome dude. I remember going to the shows and, oh my God, there's a Magnum TA program. They had a program just for Magnum TA. And I'm like, oh, this is cool. And then I opened one page and it was like a picture of him getting out of the shower in a towel. And I was like, wait a minute, why is that in there? And I was like, oh, I'm not the demographic that picture is aimed for.
Is there also the motorcycle one where he's like sprawled out?
Yeah. Yeah. So I thought he was cool. Because the first time I ever saw him, he gave the belly-to-belly suplex to Kamala. And I was like, oh, my God, the belly-to-belly suplex, was great. It was just out of nowhere. And then he did it to Kamala, which was mind-boggling at that point.
How can he do this?
Exactly.
He's so strong. Yeah.
So those guys. And then once he had the accident and Nikita Koloff turned babyface, and that was a big deal in the territory. And I got to see, like, the Rock and Roll Express beat the Russians for the belts, which was one of my favorite matches that I ever saw as a kid.
It's amazing how it was back then, because like you said, there was no YouTube to check out the different places. You could just hear about it. Like, I remember hearing about Mid-South Atlantic, or hearing about, like, you know, the Olympic Auditorium, California Wrestling, Chavo Guerrero, whatever, those guys. Mm-hmm. But you would never have any idea. It was like Columbus and the world is, you know, you'd never see it.
Well, right around this time, this was like the advent of cable. So all of a sudden, in addition to the stuff I was getting on my UHF, all of a sudden I watched WWF, Tuesday Night Titans on USA, or you'd watch AWA and World Class on ESPN. So all of a sudden, the stuff that I was reading about in the After magazines, I could all of a sudden see that on television. Mm. I pretended I had just motioned like I had a remote control. This was before remote controls. This was turning the dials. So,
get up, kid, and change the channel.
Yeah, exactly.
We're renting VHSs. That's how.
Right.
My first exposure was renting
Coliseum Video
WrestleMania 1 because I saw Thunder Lips and Clubber Lang on the. Because I knew them from Rocky.
Oh, wow.
And my mom rented it for me, and I saw Tito Santana wrestle, and I was hooked.
did you ever spend any time in the WWE, Chris?
Not specifically. I did one of the camps that they did with Dory Funk Jr. at Titan Towers in 98. Mm-hmm. But that was the extent of any sort of contract stuff. Like, I did dark matches after that, and, you know, when they were in town or even remotely close, I would drive and do
But just never,
matches.
Just never stuck?
Never stuck, yeah. Just the timing. Like, I never had one of those instances where they came to me and said, all right, kid, here's your shot. It was like, hey, you're available to wrestle. And so I would do dark matches, or I would do heat, or I would do jacked, or the occasional syndicated show. But never anything that was, like, long-term or, like, planned out. Like,
who did you train with?
I trained in Chicago in a place called Windy City Pro Wrestling with a guy named Sam DeCero, who was one of the Max brothers. They were sort of an underneath tag team in the AWA. And in the Chicago scene, too, they were a big deal. But, like, they were in the AWA. That's how I knew them. And Sam was trained by Randy Savage. So that was the only school that I knew of, though. This was 93 when I got trained. And so I was just like, okay, well, the AWA, I know that. He's got a good school. I'll go there. And because at that point I was, like, 180 pounds, he sort of understood that there were going to be smaller guys coming into his school. And so he was like, all right, well, we have heavyweight and we have middleweight class and we have lightweight classes. And so I was like a lightweight at that point. And we were doing, you know, what ended up becoming the cruiserweight style because that was what I watched.
Right.
And that was what I gravitated towards at that point. So
how about you, Frank? Who did you train with?
Killer Kowalski.
Oh, you're a Boston guy.
I'm a Southern California guy, but I moved out there to train.
A Boston trainer.
That's where I train. Yeah. It came about from sitting away and getting one of those books on how to become a professional wrestler by Percy Pringle or by.
Where did you get it? Where did you get it? The back of a comic?
Yeah,
book or
the back of like the back of one of the After Mags.
Yeah.
There was two of them.
One was written by King Kong Bundy and someone else, and one was written by Percy Pringle and someone else. And it's like how to enter the wacky and wonderful world of pro wrestling.
So,
and I sent my $10 in, and they basically sent you a book, like a thin book, 30, 40 pages. And it's, you know, get gear, get trained right, you know, look the part, get a tan, you know, all basically all that, you know. And then at the back, it was like, here's a list of credible wrestling schools. And
really?
Yeah. So there was all these addresses. So I mailed letters to the WCW Power Plant, to the Hart Camp, and to Kowalski's. Because those, out of all the schools, I was like, okay, I know who Killer Kowalski is.
Yes.
I know who the Harts are, obviously, and right. I know what WCW is. WCW sent me back a letter saying like, oh, well, come to the camp and it costs this much money. I think the Smith camp, or the, I'm sorry, the Hart camp sent me a letter. And I actually met Bret Hart and asked him, I said, hey, I'm an aspiring wrestler. Do you have any recommendation on where to go get trained? And he said, Killer Kowalski's turning out a lot of good students. And I was like, wow, why didn't he recommend his own? I didn't know anything at the time. So I'm like, okay.
Just quick segue, I had the same thing. I saw Bret right before at the gym because they used to work out at the Gold's Gym in Winnipeg.
Yeah.
And I told him, man, I'm going to the Hart Brothers Wrestling Camp. He's like, that still exists? And I was like, but shouldn't you know? Like, aren't you all friends? Aren't you a part of it? You know, just kind of walked
away. It's the dungeon, right?
Yeah,
right.
This is the famous dungeon.
Aren't you a guest trainer on Thursdays?
Yeah, no. That's what they told me.
I'm not going.
So based on that, I said, well, if Bret Hart told me to go to Kowalski's, I'll go there. Only problem was if it was in Massachusetts. So saved up, scrapped together the money I could and made the hike from Southern California.
Did you drive or fly?
Oh, I drove.
You drove?
I had a 1983 Chevy Citation that was a piece of shit. Blew out two tires in Amarillo, Texas. Had all my belongings in the back. Drove, got there.
How did you get the tires fixed?
Well, I had had all my stuff in the back. It was a hatchback and the ugliest car in human history. Blew out the first one. Unloaded all my stuff out of the back, put the spare on, driving about another 20 minutes around, bam, the other one goes. I'm like, oh my God. And this is like right on the outskirts of Amarillo, pulled into a mall, and there was like a Sears auto, and I'm like, God.
Oh, lucky that there was one.
Thank God, because I was literally driving on that for only a few miles and just told him to replace the two back tires and like gave him money. I was like, oh, which I was already hurting for.
That was half of your savings.
Exactly. So, yeah, and finally made it up to made it up to Massachusetts.
Was Kowalski actually training?
He was there. I had the luxury of becoming friends with him, meaning like he would pick me up at my where I lived, and we'd go like have breakfast or go to church or whatever, and then go to the class. So I would always get there 2 hours before everyone else because he was perpetually early. So we would get there, and he would literally get in the ring and show me stuff, and or just sit there and talk and tell me stuff. So I had a lot more hands-on training from Killer than other guys did because at the time he was in his late 70s.
Right.
And so he was, you know, a lot of times he would sit outside, and if he saw something that was good, he would say it was good. If he more than often, he would say if that was the shits, it was the shits. And
how does he say it, though?
I go, those are shits, dude. Stop. He would always do this. Like we would we'd put a match together and it would be like a tackle drop down. And so like we'd start off headlock, tackle drop down. As soon as you do drop down, stop. That's the shits. Why, you know, do that again. And he'd make the guy get on the ground. If a guy did that, I'd stomp him. He'd stomp the guy and I'd be like, okay, I'm sorry. Like it's just
because Perry Saturn has the exact same impression.
Oh yeah. Everybody
that's
does.
The shits.
Oh, that's, oh yeah.
I think Hunter too. Yeah.
Oh yeah. It was, but you know what? It was terrifying. Cause he's a giant man, and he was really intimidating, but at the same time, the absolute sweetest man I ever met. And
you know, at least you know you're getting trained properly by a guy like that, right?
Exactly, and you know, you're paying your dues, and he was such a sweetheart, and literally, I would not have, you know, had the career I had without him. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your WCW experience, Chris. You mentioned that you were there, and I know that you were there right before they went into the, how did you get signed?
I had a dark match. When Nitro did LA, I had a dark match against a guy named Mikey Henderson, and Kevin Sullivan was in charge at that point. And so he called me. This was like in January of 2000. And he called me. He says, how'd you like to join? Absolutely. Yes, sir. And so I said, I have one last tour of Japan because I was working for Michinoku Pro, and I actually had one of their championships at the time. And I said, I have one last tour of Japan. I will give them my notice. And I'm all yours at that point. And so I signed the contract. I went over to Japan. And while I was in Japan, this was when Kevin got fired and Vince Russo and Eric Bischoff got hired. And I don't know if you remember the night that everything changed in Denver, Colorado, that Nitro where they basically vacated all the titles and gave the titles to the people that they wanted to give them to in the ring. That was supposed to be my debut under Kevin's regime.
Oh.
But he got let go. I came in, and I called WCW, and I was like, the guy that hired me is gone now? Do I still have a job? And they're like, yeah, you signed a contract with WCW, not Kevin Sullivan, so yeah, you have a job. So I would call in, and you know, they would have you call the number to see if you're booked.
Yeah.
And so I would call in, and all of a sudden, I was on the list, and so I started traveling, and I remember Vince Russo, this was the first day I traveled on that deal. Was when Goldberg wrestled Vince Russo in Atlanta. And so I was in Atlanta by myself. I rented a car, and they said, yeah, Vince Russo has some ideas that he wants to talk to you about. So just wait for him at the end of the night, and he wants to give you the ideas that he has. I was like, awesome, great. So he goes and he wrestles this match, and he's tired. And at the end of the show, he went back to where Bob Ryder and Jeremy Brash were doing the internet show. And I'm like waiting for him, and he's still doing all that stuff. And like an hour and a half after the show's done, finally, he's got time to see me. And I walk up to him. I'm like, Christopher Daniels, nice to finally meet you, sir. Thank you for everything. He goes, great, great. So what ideas do you have? And I go, wait, you don't have the ideas? So then I pitched him like me being the Fallen Angel, which I had been doing on the indies. And we talked a little bit. And somehow that turned into me being Vampiro's boss. Like they wanted to pitch me, like the pitch to me was, okay, well, if Vampiro is Darth Vader, you're going to be the Emperor. And so they literally had me shoot one segment, a backstage segment where I'm in a hood, I'm in a big cloak, and I'm sitting sideways. So like the camera's like shooting me profile, and I'm talking to him, and they wanted me to do this wacky voice and talk about gathering souls for the upcoming harvest. And I could do all this stuff, and I'm like, great, I think that went well. And then they play it live, and I'm in the locker room, and they play the segment live, and all of a sudden it ends, and Jeff Jarrett, who happened to be there, goes, what the hell was that shit? And I'm just like, oh.
So, didn't see you in the corner.
Yeah, no, well, he didn't know who it was because I was all covered up, so you didn't see my face at all, just this terrible voice saying things about souls.
And you're like, yeah,
and
what was that? That was the
like,
shit.
Oh, that's me, sir, and yeah. And that was it. Like, the next week, they're like, oh, that didn't go the way we wanted to, and we're going to change the direction, and And to me, I was like, it didn't make any sense for me to be revealed as Vampiro, because Vampiro at that point was a big star. He was doing stuff with Sting.
Right.
And I was like, I had no name. So for them to go like, hey, everybody, it's Christopher Daniels as Vampiro's boss. You're like, who?
Yeah.
Exactly. And I was like, oh, so I knew. Well, like once that got done, I just waited. I just kept showing up and like, what do you got for me today? Oh, nothing. And I sat and I traveled with them for like 6 months and didn't wrestle again. I did one Thunder match, or no, not Thunder, a worldwide match with Chris Candido that weekend in Atlanta. And then like I traveled with them for 6 months. And then one day I got a call from JJ Dillon. He was like, you know, for the amount that you're wrestling and the amount we're paying you, you're not wrestling a whole lot. And I was like, that's not on me.
Right. Yeah.
It's not like I'm asking for the days off. You guys aren't booking me. And so he let me go. And then the next week they were in Long Beach doing Thunder. And I showed up and they gave me a Thunder match or a worldwide match again. And they were like, I thought you were fired. And I was like, I am fired. I'm just doing this.
He just pulled a Costanza.
I'm a local guy. I'm a local guy today, even though I was just under contract 2 weeks ago.
When you were talking about doing those dark matches, Frankie, did they ever ask you to cut your hair?
They asked me that when I was actually employed. Yeah.
Oh, because you actually had a gig with WWE.
Yeah, I had a job.
How did
there.
You get a job there?
Tommy
I remember
Dreamer.
This.
Tommy Dreamer, Nova, who I was, Mike Bucci was a pal of mine, and we were tag team partners back in the day, and he was working there at the time, and I remember literally just reading something about WWE issue statement. They're not hiring anybody that's not at least 6 foot and not at least 200 pounds. And I'm like, I'm like, well. And I did have a contract with TNA at the time. They had, astonishingly, TNA had forgotten to roll me over. So I was just basically working, you know, contract free. And I told Nova this, and he told Tommy this. And Dreamer calls me, and he's like, I hear you don't have a contract with TNA. And I'm like, I don't. And he's like, would you like to come work here? And I was like, I'd love to, but I didn't think they were hiring. So I was kind of shocked. So I sent him my contract, and they sent it to legal. And he's like, you're free to go. So I went. Signed and sat at home and sat at home. I signed in February and sat at home. And it was at the point where I was calling like Johnny and I was like, hey, I'd love to come to, like, they put me on the road the first few weeks and just did dark matches and stuff, but I was hearing nothing. And I was like, I was getting almost like, I was like, I don't want ring rust to kick in, you know? And
it's frustrating.
You know, I was just like sitting at home and, you know, people are like, don't worry about it. Just get paid. But you can tell me that at the time. And, you know, and still I like to work.
Of course.
You know, and then so I'm calling Johnny. He's like, well, do you want to move to Atlanta? And I'm like, no, like I, not necessarily, but, and so then they sent me to OVW for 1 week and I did that, which was cool. Cause that was like Lance Storm's like last week training there. So it was cool to, you know, learn a little bit from him, pick his brain and stuff. And then they put me on the road for, I started on doing velocity matches and I was there for a few months doing that. And then the suggestion was to cut my hair. And, at that point I wasn't mature enough to be there. All I knew about wrestling was some Japan, TNA and Indies. I didn't know how to treat it as a business. Mm-hmm. And that's 100% on me. They could have suggested, hey, switch your tights. And I would have done the same.
Right.
I was, it was like, you know what? No, I'm not getting, you know, you brought me in to do this and I'm not going to do that. And I was, I have a rebellious spirit. Mm-hmm. And it's cost me jobs and stuff, but I wasn't ready. If I would have stayed, I wouldn't have lasted long anyways, just because I wasn't mentally ready to treat it like a business.
Right.
The way, you know, that
the grind of it. Yeah,
right. Exactly. It was still, and in the back of my mind, I knew, oh, I can go back to TNA because they told me if anything happens, you can come back. Well, that was, you know, I sat at home for 9 months doing indie. So it was, you know.
How long was it when they asked you to cut your hair until you got let go?
The conversation happened and I got home and I called Johnny. I said, I don't want to cut my hair. And he goes, let me ask you a question. Do you want to work here? And I go, honestly, no, I don't. I said, it's not meeting my expectations. And again, that's not on them.
Yeah,
it's
the
WWE. That's on me. I had a chip on my shoulder at the time. I was, like I said, I was young. I didn't know what to expect. And I wasn't having fun. I felt more comfortable back when I was doing dark matches. Like I said, when I was plopping
bag.
Everyone seemed a lot more friendly back then. It just when I was there as an employee, I felt like I was walking on eggshells all the time. And that could be me. That could just be a character flaw in me.
Not knowing any better. Like
exactly. You know, but it didn't meet my expectations. And I take 100% responsibility.
I've never told you this before because we've never really talked about this. I was standing talking to Vince and Johnny came over. And they mentioned your name and that he said that he doesn't want to cut his hair. And Vince was like, well, maybe you should get rid of him, John. And I was like, okay, Vince, I'll be over here. Because I had this idea, and I was like, fighting for it. Well, yeah. Maybe you should get rid of him then. And I was like, okay. So that's what I was like. That must have been when you said,
yep.
I don't want to cut my hair.
When I called him, yeah. How ballsy or stupid, you know? But, like, it was just, like, one of those things, like, you know, like, this is when they were revamping the cruiserweight division, which you know,
didn't
last either. And I was like, okay, well,
it's not a cruiserweight company.
Right. It's not. But it's like, you're bringing me in to do this, and I have this certain look, and
I got you.
Just, you know, it is what it is. I don't regret anything. Could things have been different? Maybe, but I'm pretty thrilled with the way things turned out.
There's a lot of places to go in the wrestling world, you know, and if you guys are good, you'll always get a chance.
Absolutely.
But let's talk about, you mentioned Michinoku in Japan. I want to talk about, the very mysterious wrestler known as Curry Man.
Bastard.
Kind of a bastard, yeah.
Oh, complete bastard.
Owes you money, right?
And a year of my life. Yeah. Yes, money and a year of my life.
Yes, and he's an alcoholic.
Okay. So Curry Man, for those of you who have been initiated, mask with a giant bowl of curry on the top of it.
Yes.
And I know Michinoku was a Lucha Libre-influenced company, but very wacky gimmicks as well.
Yeah, they did a... every 4 years, they did a tournament, a round robin tournament called the Masked Man Tournament. And literally in April of 1999, I did a tour as myself, a week tour. And at the end of that, they said, oh, we'd love if you come back in May for the Masked Man Tournament and we'll take care of it. And I go, okay. So I get there the first day of that tournament, and a guy named Kendo, who was a Spanish speaking wrestler, older gentleman, he came up to me.
I know Kendo.
Yeah.
Mexican guy.
Yeah.
Crazy, weird flying, like spinning and jumping.
Yeah, and he would do the jumping gimmick with the feet.
And he looked like he was about 60 years old.
Yeah. He says to me, ah, you're Karema. And I go, I don't know what Karema is, but okay. So then 20 minutes later, they hand me the t-shirt that has all the names of the characters on the shirt in the tournament. And it says Curry Man. And I go, is that me? Yes, that's you. And so he tried to describe it to me. He tried to describe it to me early. He was like, ah, I think your mask, maybe food. And I go, like Carmen Miranda? Like, do I have like apples and oranges on the top of my skull? And I see it. And there was a character in Kinnikuman, which was a cartoon over there. Basically translated as Muscle Busters, called Curry Cook. And it was a guy with a bowl of rice and curry on his head. And so that was their idea. Jinsei Shinzaki, who was Hakushi, he was sort of like the main creative guy. And he was like, oh, this is the character I want to give you. I was like, okay. And I had no idea how to play it. I literally played the first 2 weeks as Apu from The Simpsons, because that was my only influence in terms of Indian. So I would hit a move, and I'd be like, oh, so sorry. And finally, Gran Hamada was like, he saw me getting frustrated because I had no idea how to play this character. And he's like, just go wrestle. Stop screwing around. Just wrestle. So after that, I was like, all right, and just did my stuff.
Now you're
and,
playing it straight.
Yeah, just wrestling. Yeah, literally just wrestling. And then after a while, I was like, wait a minute. I'm ridiculous. I have a bowl of food on my head. So then I just started having fun. I wrote the words, eat me, in Japanese, on my arm, and I started doing the wacky dance and doing the big hat that covered up the bowl.
Oh, nice.
And so then I started having fun, and then it started to get over, and all of a sudden I was pretty much on every tour.
Didn't he have a little mustache too, Curry Man, like a little Fu Manchu mustache?
No. He had teeth. He had wacky teeth. It looked like a jack-o'-lantern, with shark teeth.
Yeah.
And just a wacky grin. And so, like, I started... They gave me a yellow singlet and like Sabu baggy pants. So I was this big yellow thing. And I was like, the heck with that. I'm changing my gear. So I ended up basically getting a pair of biker short style trunks and wearing a half shirt because I was covering my tattoo so that nobody knew that was Christopher Daniels. And I basically looked like Billy Gunn without all the muscles and the strength. And I would wrestle like that. And I did the hat and the wacky dance and years passed.
Did you have like a signature move for
The spice drop? Well, they called it the spicy drop. And then in the U.S., I ended up calling it the spice rack, which I thought was wildly clever. And then they never talked about it again in TNA, which is weird, but
shocking.
So I thought that was clever.
And then when they did do it in TNA a couple times, you had like this wacky psychedelic green screen behind you with the dance and stuff.
Right. Well, I pitched the idea doing Curry Man in TNA because I had sort of come to the end of trying to do the Fallen Angel thing. I kept finding It never got over the way I wanted to, and I finally realized that I was sort of playing a character that I wasn't invested in. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, look, you guys keep asking me, why are you called the Fallen Angel? And you can do one of two things. Like, instead of trying to make me this big religious character like I had always envisioned,
supposed to be like a cult leader or something?
Yeah, it was based on, like, David Koresh. Gotcha. I wanted to be, like, this leader of men. And sort of basically what Bray Wyatt is doing now, that was what I wanted to be, was this guy that, you know, spoke in mysterious tones, and but it was very much more specifically religious. Like, he was God's gift, and gotcha. God chose him, and, you know, all the things that happened bad to you were because you were bad and God was punishing you. I was great. God loves me, blah, blah, blah. So I realized I wasn't really 100% into that. So I said, look, you can just make the Fallen Angel a nickname, like Nature Boy or Heartbreak Kid, because Shawn Michaels doesn't literally break hearts every time he goes into the ring. You can just make that a nickname, or I can be Curry Man. And they said, ah, Curry Man. And so I did a year in TNA as Curry Man.
A whole year.
And
people get into it?
Well, yeah. Well, originally, I wanted to do sort of like the Yellow Dog thing where you knew it was me. Like, I would come out and talk in my regular voice, and they'd be like, we think you're Christopher Daniels. And I'd be like, no, I'm obviously Japanese. Listen to this accent. I'm obviously Japanese. Oh, Christopher Daniels isn't, you know. And so then Jarrett came to me and says, no, we want to play this up like you're a completely different person. So they suggested me doing the bodysuit, and I put a wig and the mask so that I had hair underneath and completely played it.
Did the Liger voice.
Yeah, I did the Liger voice.
Which is, what's that?
Liger's voice is like, maybe today, really bit wrestling, then maybe Switch, then Brainbuster, okay. Yeah, that'll be fine.
Maybe.
Really? Yes.
Maybe something action.
Maybe action,
something.
Then Switch, then finish, okay. So yeah, so that was my thing. And
that's perfect, by the way.
I did the first couple times. I thought, okay, he speaks no English. So, and I didn't know a whole lot of Japanese. So I would go out there and just I would say Japanese wrestlers' names. And the only people that would get it would be the people that knew Japanese wrestling. So I'd come out and I'd go, Misawa Mitsuharu, Ikuto Hidaka, you know, all this stuff. And Mike Tanay on television, he goes, he's naming off all the Japanese wrestlers, you know. And I go, no, that's supposed to be Japanese words. They don't know. Don't blow my spot. So then, like, 3 months down the road, I was like, wait a minute, I've been in the U.S. for a while, so now I'm going to start talking in English. So I started doing the Liger voice, and today, Kazu, you and me, tag, we're wrestling.
So enthusiastic, right?
Oh, yeah. Maybe today, you tag. And
did you have any other gimmicks, or was it always Frankie Kazarian?
I was brooding Raven lackey Kaz for a while. I was goth for about 4 months, yeah.
Okay,
And there's rumors that I was the suicide character, but
everyone knows that was Samoa Joe.
Yeah, Samoa Joe and Angelina Love.
In separate,
obviously.
Obs. Yeah, Obs, come on.
There were rumors that we were both the suicide character,
lame. There was a rumor that I was the suicide character, actually. No, someone thought I was Sin Cara when he first came out. I'm like, really? Jericho's coming back, you're Sin Cara. Like, first of all, I can't do that. And second, really? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I'm not, Rick Rude, but there's a little bit of a reference on a body type here. Right. What was the curry bowl made of?
The mask guy in Japan, he made it out of this, like, it was like a leather. First of all, the bowl itself was like just a pad. It was like a foam pad.
Yeah.
And then he stitched this white leather around the top of it so it looked like a bowl. And just like he would make, first it was just straight white on one side and whatever color the mask was. Like, if it was a yellow mask, it was yellow. And then he got more and more creative. Like, every time I would go to Japan, he'd be like, oh, it's a new mask. And then I'd be like, oh, this has rice and carrots in it, because there'd be orange and green spots in it. I was like, okay. So it was just different colored stuff, and he would add to it every time, and it was just more and more ludicrous.
Japanese people, they like weird stuff like that.
Somehow it got over. Like, I think part of me just going out there and, like, the hell with it. I'm going to go out there and have fun, and the heck with what everyone else says. That, for some reason, got...
You committed to it.
Yeah, exactly. And right. At a certain point, like, they invited me... New Japan invited me to do the Best of the Super Juniors for a year, in 1 year. And I got to know, like, Liger. I did the tour with Liger and all those guys. And at the end of it, he says, please come back. Please come back. And I was like, would you like me to come back full time? Because Michinoku wasn't doing a lot of tours at that point. And I was like, I'd love to come to New Japan. And so Sasuke, who was the boss at Michinoku, I asked him if it was cool, and he was like, yeah, go. So I went to New Japan for a year and a half, maybe 2 years.
Wow.
I did, yeah. So, I mean...
Different, Michinoku is a very small high school gymnasium company, basically, and obviously New Japan's New Japan.
Yeah, I mean, this was 2003, 2004, so it's not like it is now, but it was still, you know, the difference between being, you know, to them, at that point, that was WWF to me.
Well,
that was like the Japanese WWF. So
but Michinoku was famous for being like a very small promotion that would literally go to high schools and everyone would sit on the floor.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't always like that. They would do bigger shows that would be in venues.
Yeah, of course.
But like on the touring schedule, lots of basketball gyms, and they would lay out the tarps on all four sides of the ring and people would sit on the floor.
Was there other wacky gimmicks there?
The mass tour that I did, the characters that they made up for the thing, because they had, you know, Grand Naniwa and Tiger Mask and Sasuke, who were established characters, but there was Curryman, there was basically a black mouse named Dako-chan. It was basically Mickey Mouse ears, and here's the kid that played him was Jody Fleisch, who wrestled in England. And then there was another British guy named anyway, he wrestled as White Bear, and he was just White Bear, and they were like, it's White Bear. Yeah, and
bottom of the barrel for gimmicks, right?
Just making stuff
Red
up.
Ant.
So yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's funny. I remember Grand Niwa, he was like a crab.
Right.
And I worked him a few times, and he would walk the ropes, and he'd make a crab
the
motion.
Deal. Yep.
Oh yeah.
And if you look on the only time I was ever on the front cover of Weekly Gong magazine,
right,
which was at the end of a Super Junior tournament, I won like the Fighting Spirit Trophy, and I'm doing this where you think I'm doing like, you know,
the Japanese
brother.
Peace symbol.
I'm actually doing the crab sign because I was laughing actually with Ben while we were laughing how stupid the crab guy was. Like, because he would go, wonk, wonk, wonk.
That's still replicated to this day. We still do that.
Oh, yeah.
And he'd take his mask off. He's just this nerdy looking, like chubby Harry Potter glasses wearing guy.
He took me to, after the second week of that first tour as Curryman, they brought me into a curry restaurant, and they were like, oh, we're going to do a feature on you. We want you cooking the curry. So I was in my mask doing the curry, and they're like, okay, now take a bite. And I took a bite, and it was the worst thing I'd ever eaten. I hated it. And I got so – at this point, I was like, I didn't know what I was doing. So I Naniwa took me out, and we got wildly, wildly drunk. And I was just like, man, I don't understand this. And he was like, chika, it's okay. You played. Yeah, fine, no problem. Wildly drunk. The next day we wrestled in a parking lot, and I remember taking a bump, like a tackle, and I was like, oh, I feel too ill.
The bubbling crew.
He's like, relax, you curry man, I'm a fucking crab.
Yeah,
think how bad it is for me. Did you spend any time in Japan?
I did some stuff with 01 when they first started, like 2001.
Otani was involved?
Otani was there, yep. And Samoa Joe was going over there a lot at the time. Steve Corino, C.W. Anderson.
How'd you like that style?
It was cool. I dug it. Me and I first went over there. Nova and I went over as a tag, and so we were tagging, of course. And it was cool. I dug it. And then he got signed, and I continued to go over for another year. And it was I loved it. I always wanted to go to Japan, so that was a good in. That lasted up until I started with TNA. And then that was the end of that. And then just recently, last year, we went back to New Japan and did the Tag League Tournament. And earlier this year. So, yeah.
So, like you said, going back to Japan in 2015 for New Japan, now it's became
now
very,
it's
very
the
huge,
deal,
right?
Yeah.
Did you guys, and now being a team, are you mostly Ring of Honor now, or how are you guys working your bookings?
We're both under contract with Ring of Honor.
Yeah, okay,
so exclusively I signed in January, and he just recently
and,
signed.
And so we can still do stuff internationally and stuff, but as far as in the States, it's all.
But let's talk about Ring of Honor. I'm glad I wasn't aware that you guys were specifically with them, but it's becoming a thing. Like, it's becoming a legit, is it number two in America at this point?
Debatable. You certainly know? There are plenty of people that would say that, especially with the troubles that TNA has been going through in the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But when I left there, I was there in 2010. I'd left TNA for a year. They let me go. And I went back to Ring of Honor at 2010. And when they brought me back to TNA, and I was doing Ring of Honor and TNA at the same time.
Really? They allowed that?
Yeah. Well, the original plan was they wanted me to be Suicide again. Uh-huh.
Suicide's a masked character.
Right. And so they wanted me to be Suicide again, and Ring of Honor let me do a deal where I signed a contract with them, and they said, if you are under a mask, you can go wrestle for those guys. Well, one day they call me, and they go, hey, can you be here tomorrow? And I was like, yeah, what am I doing? They go, oh, you're going to be you because you're going to come back and save AJ from Bubba.
Yeah.
And so I went and I called Ring of Honor and I was like, and this, at this point, Ring of Honor, they were doing like one show a month. And I was like, hey, man, I need the work.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Carrie Silken was like, I'm not happy about this, but I'm not going to keep you, you know, I'm not going to make you starve. So go do what you got to do. And, you know, it was a little uncomfortable. The next time I was at ROH, I went up in front of the locker room. I was like, look, guys, I'm not disrespecting you. This is an opportunity for me to feed my family. And so I did that for about 2 or 3 months. And right when they got television with Sinclair, when Sinclair bought Ring of Honor and started to do the Sinclair television shows now that are going on now, I was the television champion and I dropped the belt to El Generico. And they had just started, like Sinclair just bought the company. And they're like, okay, we're going to do all these good things. I go away for 4 years. I get let go. I come back and they're like, yeah, we'd love to have you back. And I was like, well, I've got a partner. Do you mind if I bring him with me? And they're like, yes, bring him along. So we come back three and a half years later and it's their first broadcast pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel very fortunate that they, you know, they could have absolutely said, we don't have any room for you, man. We've been building these guys up for the last 3 years. We have no room for you. But they gave me a spot. They gave him a spot. He'd never been in. He'd wrestled one match in Ring of Honor in his whole career.
Yeah.
And so I felt very fortunate that they gave us the opportunity to debut on their first.
And at the time, our tag act was still hot, like at least with the people. Everyone loved it. You know,
yeah.
Everyone loved our act when we were doing Bad Influence in TNA. And it was getting over.
And regardless. What was the act? Just the team?
Or it was us. The team just doing tickle butt and being us.
Yeah, basically, it's sort of like what the New Day is doing now. Honestly.
Oh, really?
It was very much like us getting out there and doing wacky stuff. I remember one day we were on a loop and there was an actual – we were on a loop, house show loop. I go to a mall in North Dakota and there's like a Zubaz kiosk. And I'm like, how many guys want Zubaz? So literally 13 wrestlers like, get me a pair of Zubaz. So he and I were like, hey, do we have the balls to wear this on national television? So we came out and we did a thing called Throwback Thursday. And we came out in Zubaz and rag tops and we wrestled in them.
Without asking management. And it was Thursday and it was like Throwback Thursday. So we did Zubaz. So the next time we did it, it was overseas. We did
Braveheart.
We did Braveheart. It was a throwback. Yeah, we threw it back to the
so you guys would make that your gimmick.
So every once in a while we'd do Throwback Thursdays.
In Chicago, the first time we did TV Live, we did the Legion of Boom. Without asking, we had gear made, like LOB gear, painted our face, and literally when we were about to go out for a match, like Bruce Pritchard's like, wait a minute, what's going on here? And we're like, oh, Throwback Thursday. He's like, you can't call yourself LOD. We're like, well, no, we're LOB. Check it out.
Legion of Boom, Bruce.
So we did that.
All right, all right.
Yeah.
All right.
We did Siegfried and Roy in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
We came out as Siegfried and Roy. And,
the last one we did, we were in the UK, and we came out as the old school Dynamite Kid, Davey Boy Smith. We called ourselves the Best Coast Bulldogs.
Wow.
And they almost didn't let us do it. We were like, hey, we want to do this. They're like, nope, that'll get over too much.
So
they
put us,
they said, you guys are going to steal the segment, and that's not what the business is about. And we were like, the business is us doing the job. Who cares what we're dressed as?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And they fought us on it. And we're like, fine.
Business is kind of about stealing the segment, though.
I was always taught, if that red light's on, if you steal the segment, that's
on you. Follow that,
right,
dude.
Exactly.
Right.
So
right.
This was the battles we were continuously fighting at the end there. And that was it. Oh, it's going to steal. It's going to be too entertaining. And right then I just threw my hands up like, okay.
Just that statement alone tells you why the TNA is in the dire straits. It's too entertaining. Right?
But stuff like that. So that became our shtick. And that's what people like, oh, I loved your guys' Throwback Thursday, or I loved your impression of AJ, or I loved your, you know.
What's the impression of AJ?
Just, we did it. AJ left the company after the whole Claire Lynch thing. He got so frustrated and upset.
And I beat him in a match. I beat him in what was billed as our last match ever.
Yeah.
And the next day he goes, you know what? I'm done with this. And he leaves the company.
Yeah,
and so I took credit for it. And then one day I come out and I go, you know what, everybody? We did say, TNA did say it was going to be the last time, but we only met until the next time, so let's bring out AJ. And he comes out in AJ's gear.
Pyro and everything, the place goes crazy, and they realize it's me, and it's boo.
Yeah.
And I get in, and I'm just like, Christopher Daniels, I would like nothing more than to wrestle you one more time. But here's the thing. And I just go into this whole thing.
Here's the thing.
Well, because he's just one of my best friends.
Yeah,
so I just listened to him talk so much, and it was
I just finished working with him, and one of the things when you're putting together the match, he doesn't swear.
Right. He says frick.
And another one that he does is be like, okay, I'll pick you up. Like, come here, you. And then I'll throw you over there. So then yeah. Go for a bike. Come here, you. Come here, you. It's funny, you know, when you've been around someone for a while. I'm still, by the way, I can't get out of my craw that there's still a Zubaz kiosk in North Dakota.
But why wouldn't there be? I lost my mind. I was like, I texted everybody on the roster, guys, look, Zubaz. And literally, I had 10 people like, hey, can you get me a pair of, like,
I want pink and blue. I want the Rams.
Give me the Rams colors. Like, I don't even know what the Rams colors are.
It's like seeing a dinosaur. It's like, there's one left. It's right there. That's right there. You mentioned that Ring of Honor brought you back with all these other guys, but I think one of the reasons is that you guys are veterans at this point. You're probably good to have guys like you in the locker room with so many young guys, I would assume.
Yeah, and we got, it was fortunate, like the situation in TNA was we were the only established tag team, and for some reason they kept going with everybody else.
Makeshift teams, yeah.
They would put teams together, like makeshift guys. We were always like, if they wanted two baby faces to go out there and have a competitive TV match, it was always us. You know, we wrestled like Bubba and Sting and Bubba and Jeff Hardy and all of these, you know, all these makeshift teams. And then we get to Ring of Honor and there's Red Dragon, the Young Bucks, the Briscoes, like 8 or 9 different tag teams. War Machine, the All Night Express just recently came back. So now, like, it's almost an embarrassment of riches how many tag teams are there. And, like, the benefit for us at this point is, like, we're definitely – not as a team specifically, but like I'm 23 years in. He's 18. Almost okay, 18. So like we're literally
the most
experienced guys in the ring at any given moment. And so like that's sort of been our go-to is like.
And the tag team scene there is like you was just mentioned all those names, and I love tag team wrestling, and there's really a focus on it at Ring of Honor, which is cool.
There's an art form to it as well.
Absolutely, you know? It's just so exciting. There's so much more you could do in a tag match than
I love having tags. Yeah. We had one last week on SmackDown, the first one I've had in ages, and it's just so much. You just go bing boom, and you come in, you make the save, you do this. It's obviously singles matches are great, but a great tag team match, I don't think you can beat it.
I agree 100%. Yeah. That's why I'm happy to be a tag team wrestler. I have no problem being a tag team. Mm. I've been a singles wrestler a long time. I have no problem being a tag team specialist. I love it.
I had the Young Bucks on the show, and we were talking about the Meltzer driver how you guys helped them.
I made him do it.
Yeah.
What did you do?
Well, we
this is a crazy move.
It is a crazy move, and this was a PWG show, and PWG I wrestled with those guys on their first show. I've been with them for a long time. I don't really
It's a small building, right? It sells out, and people are nuts for it.
Niche product. Yeah. It's all, you know, there's people that go there aren't even wrestling fans or PWG fans, and literally every match is a can you top this? And so this night specifically, it was one of the All-Star weekends, and there was just a ton of really really good matches, and we're like, okay, we can have a good match because we know those guys. We're friends with them. We've had a lot of really really good entertaining matches with them, and Nick was telling me, he's like, oh, we're thinking of doing our finish, but I was going to front flip with it. And he just kind of said it in passing, and we were putting it together. I said, dude, you have to do that move. I said, you have to. And he's like, really? I mean, you absolutely have to. Like, you know, we started that particular match with the Young Bucks super kicking the announcer. As the announcer named, they super kicked him, and then we all beat the shit out of the announcer. Because why not?
Times first.
And then, so it was that kind of match, and I was like, you have to, you know,
the original thing was just supposed to be a springboard.
It was supposed to be a
driver.
Springboard spike tombstone. So this time he does it, and he flips with it. And I said, do it to me, man. I said, it's fine. I said, as long as you can do it, and I know you're athletic enough to do it, do it. So that night, they busted it out, and the driver was born.
It's the same bump for you either way.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah, close your eyes and wait.
You don't even see it.
Yeah,
you don't
exactly.
even see it.
You're but it was just, it was like an idea. It's like, oh, it'd be cool if I did the front flip. And I'm like, dude, you have to. You absolutely have to tonight. I'm like, dude, you're absolutely doing it.
And obviously went bonkers and people went nuts for it.
Yep.
Now, you just did one the other day of, like, the best moonsault Meltzer driver.
We did a play on it, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Which is nuts.
We've been trying to have, like, one of the things about the Young Bucks at Ring of Honor, like, they were always brought in as, like, an attraction, but they never really had, like, a feud. They always would do dream matches, which is awesome. But after a while, you're like, okay, well, they've wrestled everybody that they can wrestle. So once we got there, and we were sort of out of the tag team title picture, and I said, well, let us be the antagonists and let them be the baby faces that they are. Like, they act sort of heelish, but it's the cool heel.
Yeah,
so they're over.
People love them, right?
And exactly. Let us be the bad guys. Let us be the guys that are there to bump around for those guys.
Yeah.
And so we did a beatdown on them one night where we basically did all their moves to them and did a feud. And finally, they were like, I said, what if we did this? Like, I went to them. I went to a show that they were at. And I was like, hey, guys, do you think we could do the Meltzer driver, but if it's me doing the moonsault? And they both were like, yeah, we could do that. And so it just happened, like, the next match that we did was us and them and the Motor City Machine Guns in a three-way. And it just so happened that we got the
Duke
honors, yeah.
Did the favors for us that night.
Yeah, and so, yeah. And I was like, it has to be that. Yep. It has to be that. If we never win another match again, that's the match where we do this move, and it turns into not just, hey, this is a cool move, but it's also, hey, we just topped you, Young Bucks, and now
Have him in a spike, in a pile driver? Him, and what did you do? Did you moonsault?
He does the best moonsault ever, which is the double jump.
And I just bounced over, and as I'm going over top of him, he sort of steps into position, and I just jammed. And
so you land
on my feet and that was jammed great. Him as he does the spike.
I happened to see it on YouTube, and I had to watch it a couple of times. But you also have to almost have it explained to you because you can't quite figure it out. Like, what the hell did you just do that?
Right.
You
know? It's funny because, like, I thought when we set for it, I expected, like, a bit of a buzz. And at first, everybody was like, what the hell? Is he doing a deal?
There's no way.
Yeah, and as soon as I did it, though, then they started to buzz. Yep. They're like, oh, we just saw that.
They can't believe it's real.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So I got more of a reaction after, but, like, I thought it was going to buzz once he had him in the tombstone. And I got to the corner. I thought, oh, they got to know. I don't springboard. I don't do anything else but moonsault.
Yeah.
And so, like, once it happened, then all of a sudden, everybody's like, oh,
it was awesome.
My goodness.
It worked, man.
So, oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Cool.
A couple more things. I did a promo a few weeks ago, and I called myself a ring general. I got just blasted on Twitter. I love the ring because I looked it up. It's like you actually wear a general's outfit to the ring.
I got blasted by Chris Daniels on Twitter for calling myself the ring general.
Yeah. Hey, ridiculous.
Oh, you said something back. Like,
I did.
It's all
right. Well, here's the thing. Like, everybody, like, my Twitter blows up, and I hadn't seen it yet.
And I didn't even know. I didn't know you're the ring general.
Right. And so, like, and all of it is like, oh, Chris Jericho stealing your thing. And I was like, my thing.
But my thing. So now you're thinking I'm coming out with a general's outfit on or something.
He's calling himself the ring general. Chris, what are you going to do about it? I'm like, nothing. Tweet that he's just as qualified to call himself a ring general as me. Goodness gracious, man. It's just people that they're like, the WWE guys just watch the independents and steal. No, they don't. Jesus, I mean, it's wrestling. Everybody's done everything.
But you know, wrestling fans just like
they're
to complain.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
passionate,
yeah.
There's so many.
And they want to stir.
Oh,
stir
they stir it up. Right, right. But I do love the ring general outfit. Like, if you get it, it's brilliant.
Yeah, right.
And if you don't, you look like a guy who's wearing a freaking.
Yeah.
Like in Japan.
Oh, right.
And they go, when we went out for the New Japan Tag League in November. Who was it?
Ghetto. Yeah, Ghetto comes up.
He goes, your gimmick, Hitra?
No.
I was like, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not. No, sir.
I can see him saying
that. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Last question. What's your if you had to pick what your favorite match of all time or a few of them?
That I've had?
Yeah.
In singles, two matches, and I picked these two because they happened back-to-back, and they really elevated my game, was pay-per-view in 2007. I had a ladder match against Christian, who's a really good friend of mine and a
tremendous
one of the most underrated wrestlers ever. And we had a ladder match, and I don't know if the expectations weren't high for it, but we tore it up and had a great ladder match. And the stipulation was whoever won got to wrestle Kurt Angle for the belt the next week on TV. So I won the match, which people weren't expecting. So that really put me on the map. And then that week I had a match with Kurt, like a 25-minute TV match, which was exactly, you know, it was my first time wrestling Kurt. So I was nervous as hell, but we, again, tore it up. It was great. So those two, just in terms of what they did for me in the world of wrestling as a tag team, we've had so many good ones with the Bucks and like the Briscoes. But one that stands out is when we had against Kurt Angle and AJ Styles at Slammiversary 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Those two guys.
Can't go wrong.
Yeah, you can't have a bad match. But just the stars aligned. Just it was a great crowd, great opponents, just awesome action. Probably still my favorite match we've had. There's a lot of other ones. Yeah. Hopefully I haven't had my best match yet. But
what do you think? Yeah. Chris?
For me, just by myself, it's I think it's the go-to. Like, everybody talks about the first three-way that I ever had with AJ Styles and Samoa Joe.
Yeah, maybe the best match in TNA history.
Yeah, and I'm very proud of the fact that even after, like, guys like Kurt and Christian came through, people still sort of point at to that as like the best match TNA ever had. And so like that's always the one that people talk about. Oh, I love your first three. And I was like, well, you know, that's it stood the test of time. And those guys, like you said about Kurt and AJ.
Especially Kerry and those two guys.
You can't go wrong with those two guys. And again, that was one of those things where the stars aligned and everything sort of came together for that particular match. I was going to mention the same tag match with Kurt and AJ, but because he already did, as far as ROH, I think the first night the time we first won the belt against Red Dragon.
That was a great match too, yeah.
We wrestled them in San Antonio, and we had already wrestled them a couple times and realized that we had really good chemistry with them. They were, you know, on top of the world at that point. It was the third time that they had been the champions. And I just remember, like, thinking, okay, well, now we're in the thick of it now. We're not just guys that just came from TNA. Now we're the ROH tag champs. Yeah. And we're, you know, like you said, part of the team. Yep. And I felt like that was sort of the turning point from being, oh, these guys from this other place to, okay, now we're here, now we're established. And
we turned heel that night. Too,
so, I mean, again, the stars aligned and it just worked out in our favor for us to be like what we wanted to be, which is the main antagonists in this, in a company where your work rate is not the only key, but it's certainly a major key in what gets you over in Ring of Honor. If we can be the guys that are like that fly in the ointment, because there's so many great teams, and whether they're heel or babyface, people respect the hard work, and we wanted to be the team that was like,
there's no one cheering us.
Oh, these guys are cool. You know, we wanted to be the dicks. We wanted to be the guys that were always, you know, doing the
back
and
offense. That's smart, especially in that world where everybody is trying to out-top each other, and you guys just go out there, poke somebody in the eye for a heat spot.
Right, we'll
get a reaction.
Right, and no, and like everyone wants to do the cool moves, even the heels. They want to be the cool heels. We've been the cool heels.
Yeah.
In TNA, that's what we were.
Now you want to be a heel.
Absolutely. We'd love to be a heel. We're trying to.
That's our thing. I think that's what makes us stand out from the other tag teams, you know.
Well, people respect you because you've been around, but I think it's a great mix for you guys. So great to have you, Kazarian and Hitra.
No,
it's not Hitler.
It's not.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, dude.
Okay, you can see Daniels and Kazarian in action on the upcoming Ring of Honor New Japan Pro Wrestling Tour pay-per-view starting May 8th in Chicago. Then they'll go to Dearborn, Michigan on the 9th, Toronto on the 11th, New York City on the 14th. Go to ROHWrestling.com for all ticket information. Some of the shows are sold out. Some of them still have tickets, but go check it out and see if you can get involved. You want to see one of the hottest promotions in the world today, joined with the other hottest promotion in the world today, Ring of Honor New Japan, live in person together. All right, thanks again to Daniels and Kazarian for meeting up with me in Los Angeles to do this interview. Great conversation. We will have to do it again. And hey, can't say see ya without first saying thank you to all of you Talk is Jericho listeners for supporting this podcast and all the great sponsors. And of course, that includes Amazon, the OG sponsor here on TIJ. You know what to do. Go to podcastone.com, click on the killer deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. All the links are there. All right. All the Amazon links for the USA, UK, Canada, anything that you buy on those links, Amazon will kick back a small percentage to this show to help us cover production costs. No hidden fees or extra charges. Just go to podcastone.com, click on the killer deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit Talk is Jericho. And if you buy something, when you buy something, post it on the Twitter at Talk is Jericho and become a Chris Jericho, Talk is Jericho Amazon warrior. If you post it, I will retweet it and follow you. Now that is a deal at Talk is Jericho. Don't forget, become an Amazon warrior. Let's build it up, baby. And thank you so much. Check out my other great sponsors, DDP Yoga and the DDP Yoga Now app. Go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho and you'll get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app. And you'll get a great price on the yoga program as well. You need to do this, all right? And to the work switch driver, become a handyman like me. Yeah. Use my promo code Chris and get 10% off your order and free shipping. And also go check out True Car. I bought a car through True Car. So can you. Guitar Center. I bought Ashton acoustic guitar there last week. So can you. Thank you for doing it. Thank you for listening. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. Have a great weekend. And next Wednesday, we will be here with one of the funniest new comedians coming out of the Adam Sandler, Rob Schneider stable. Nick Swardson is going to be here, and he is a nutter, completely insane, a super funny guy. You got to check him out. When you hear his voice, you'll know exactly who he is. It's needless to say, I don't have to build him up anymore. It's going to be hilarious. So we'll see you then. Stay hard, stay hungry, stay cool, and a big yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
Okay, keep your eyes closed.
Okay.
I want to show you my first ever painting.
All right.
Okay. Open your eyes.
Oh, that's a lot of colors and shapes.
So be honest. What do you think?
Well, I like how if you switch to Geico, you could save hundreds of dollars on car insurance.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Here, why don't I hold your paintbrush while you call them?
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
It's your last chance to get great holiday savings at Guitar Center. Like a Yamaha portable keyboard, only $79. Add a month of lessons for only $99. Plus the newest and hottest guitars, drums, keys, and more. Exclusive gear you can't get anywhere else. Special financing. And gift cards, the perfect present for every musician. So hurry in and find your sound at Guitar Center. Lessons available at select locations only.
Trump's victory. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute.
It's always a lot of fun when you win. If you work hard and lose, that's not acceptable.
At the White House, President Trump welcomed Republicans from the House and the Senate who passed a bill overhauling the tax code. The president says the middle class will be seeing the effects of this bill very soon.
The typical family of four earning $75,000 will see an income tax cut of more than $2,000. They're going to have $2,000, and that's, in my opinion, going to be less than the average. You're going to have a lot more than that.
The tax overhaul bill also includes a corporate tax cut.
We have companies pouring back into our country, and that means jobs, and it means really the formation of new, young, beautiful, strong companies.
Democrats have criticized the tax package as a giveaway to corporations and the rich. The tax cuts for businesses are permanent under this tax bill, but reductions for individuals and families will expire after a decade. I'm Ed Donahue.